You're listening to The Political Scene, a show about current events and the political forces driving them. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. Last week, Kyrsten Sinema announced that she would be leaving the Democratic Party and registering as an independent. It's not an unheard-of thing to do. Bernie Sanders has been an independent since the 70s, and he still caucuses with the Democrats. But Sinema's decision seems especially dramatic, given that Democrats already have such a slim majority in the Senate. As independent becomes a more popular label, with about 40% of the electorate not identifying as either Republican or Democrat, Sinema's move raises a question. What role could third parties play in a highly partisan time? Amy Davidson Sorkin is a staff writer and a regular contributor to the comments section, and she's a person I always turn to when I'm thinking about questions like this. Hey, Amy.
Hi, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
All right.
How are you feeling about Sinema as an independent?
I'm curious to see what happens next. You know, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. There's also Angus King, and they both caucus with Democrats, which means that although they're independents, they meet with Democrats in their weekly caucus meetings, and they also help the Democrats keep control of the Senate. She's not quite doing that. What she said and what, since her announcement, Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, has said is that her move isn't going to change the structure of the Senate.
Yeah, I've heard that a number of times from, like, I was watching an interview with John Tester, and he was saying the same thing, which is that this doesn't really matter. It's like a change in name alone. But, I mean, do you buy that, or is that just like a cope?
Look, it matters. It matters. But it's telling, first of all, that she waited to make her announcement until after the results of the Georgia runoff were in. Raphael Warnock won, which meant that the Democrats, before she made her change, it looked like the Democrats had 51 to 49. So they were out of this trap of just having a tie that Kamala Harris would have to break. With her as an independent, it's not that it goes back to 50-50. It goes to 50-49. Now, if Warnock had lost, it would have been a more complicated calculation for her to leave. She has said also that she's going to accept committee assignments from the Democrats. That sounds very bureaucratic to us, but it means that the Democrats, in their intricate way of doing things in the Senate, will have control over those committees still. But obviously, things are going to change. Things are going to change about how people think about her vote, whether they take her vote for granted. You know, take one example of the Inflation Reduction Act. Schumer and Manchin finally cut a deal, and they thought maybe they had it. And if they hadn't really sewn up her vote, it turned out. And the result of that was that $4 billion in drought relief money for states in the Southwest, very much like Arizona, got added to the Inflation Reduction Act. So there's that kind of leverage that you have in a really, really close Senate. And we'll see now what the way of operating is with a slightly less narrowly controlled Senate. In terms of all of these Democratic senators sort of saying nothing's changing, you know, they're talking about Washington. There's a lot that may change about the political landscape in Arizona, where Sinema hasn't yet said if she's going to run for election in 2024. She's had threats of a primary challenge. There is a lot of speculation that that's behind her decision now. You know, she won't have to deal with a primary challenge if she's not trying to get the Democratic nomination. So there are all sorts of questions and all sorts of math being done. One thing to keep in mind about Sinema, she was the first Democrat to win a Senate seat in Arizona for a few decades.
Yeah.
It's not an easy state. So she's grappling with that, too.
But it also doesn't seem like people are necessarily clamoring in Arizona for her to become an independent. You know, you mentioned earlier Manchin. You know, I mentioned John Tester. Like, there are a lot of senators who are kind of in a similar situation. But I do feel like breaking from the party is a pretty radical move.
In a way, it always is. It feels radical because it doesn't happen very often. But I'm not convinced that it's as radical in the Arizona context mm-hmm. as it might seem to us. Keep in mind that there's a lot of strange stuff going on in Arizona right now with the Arizona Republican Party, with election denying. There seems to be a fair amount of partisan turmoil in that state. She may know her state better than we do.
Even before Sinema formally became an independent, it's not like Democrats could, you know, take her vote for granted. She was always part of this kind of unofficial group of independents, like, you know, independents with a lowercase I, like her, you know, Joe Manchin, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Tester. I guess they would probably call themselves centrists or moderates. And I'm wondering, you know, how has this group of senators shaped the Biden agenda? We talked a little bit about Manchin and Sinema, but
let me just back up for a second, because we sometimes think of our political moment as the only political moment. And the idea that there are people in either party who don't vote in lockstep, that's not a new thing. I mean, think about the divisions in the Democratic and Republican parties through history, including about civil rights. So we're at a very polarized moment, which causes the focus to narrow on a few people when it's so divided. I mean, there's a parallel to how it works in presidential elections when there's a sudden extreme focus on the swing states,
yeah.
which can cause us to kind of lose sight of what's going on in the ones where, okay, we can count on that vote. It's interesting that there's a lot of Democratic anger focused on Kirsten Sinema.
Oh yeah, there's like a sense of betrayal. And I noticed that even in the like Bernie's comments about Sinema leaving the party. I mean, I forget exactly what it was he said, but he called her like a corporate Democrat. I mean, it's like all of the senators who have come out to basically say that it's fine, you know, the structure of the Senate isn't gonna change. You can tell that they're still like, oh, she's so annoying, you know?
Yeah, and I've thought, including in my own reactions, I've thought about the word that you just used, the annoying, with her. There is something gendered in I think, some of the reactions to her about the way she dresses, about that.
So that, true.
That I've thought about a lot. You know, she has a very Southwestern style to her and a very, you know, distinctive style. And that's great. But it somehow, I sometimes wonder if it keeps us from seeing just how deadly serious she is. I mean, it's interesting. Mitch McConnell has said that she's a quite effective legislator. And, you know, obviously he's not always a reliable narrator. But, you know, Chris Murphy, he gave her a lot of credit for helping to get the gun safety legislation through earlier this year, specifically about rounding up Republican votes for that. So she's blocked a lot of things that Democrats rightly care passionately about. But it's, in a way, it's a symptom of how stuck we are, that it's all, if only Sinema would change her vote, then everything would be all right. And that's not where we are, really. We're in a trickier place than that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the other sort of moderate Democrats in the Senate, I feel like a lot of them vote against, you know, Joe Biden more often than Sinema does. Like Tester, for example, is like an example of someone who I think, like, if you look at his record of voting, Sinema would look like a sort of like a more straightforward Democrat than he would. So yeah, it is interesting that so much of the discourse has focused on her. And of course, that's only going to increase now that she's no longer officially part of the party.
Yeah. And obviously, the one reason that it probably makes people nervous is because it's so tight and so much risk posed by Trump. Why are you even thinking about voting for a third party when it could make that difference? But we can't live in a permanent state of emergency on that. You know, we have to get to a point where people feel that they're voting for something and not just voting against, you know, the collapse of democracy. So I worry about how how long we stay there. I mean, again, it's not always been the case that there are no third parties. The Democratic and Republican parties are products of the mid-19th century, not since the beginning of the Republic. In 1992, Ross Perot got 18% of the popular vote for president. Now, he didn't get any electoral votes. That's a key thing. But as recently as, I think, 1968, I believe George Wallace did win electoral votes, not enough to swing the election either way. But that makes you wonder what the role of a third party might be, or a fourth party. You know, a lot of Americans are unhappy with the choices that they have. So what happens, for example, if we get to the point where a third party emerges either regionally or around a particular personality and manages to win some electoral votes, and those electoral votes make a difference? That's an interesting question that I don't think we've really worked through in every way, including legally. For example, what if Donald Trump gets the Republican nomination? Where are Republicans going to go? Are they going to stick by him? Could there be a breakaway Republican candidate or pseudo-Republican candidate?
Or what if DeSantis gets the Republican nomination and then Donald Trump runs as an independent?
Exactly. Exactly. Are there states that Trump could win?
That actually feels like kind of realistic to me. I mean, does the Democratic candidate like just win sort of by default because DeSantis and Trump would split the vote?
No, not necessarily, because I do believe that you need to get a majority of the Electoral College. It's not first past the post. What this points to is that we have a combination of a couple of structural aspects of the American electoral system that we haven't really tested how well they work together. One is the Electoral College, and there's been all sorts of discussions about that, about its ways that it's not sturdy, let's say that. And, you know, slight counter-democratic aspects to it. Democrat was small d. And then you have what's often been called a duopoly of political parties. And those things have interacted to make third parties seem like a threat and like spoilers rather than as an outlet for people's aspirations to be involved in their political system. And that has us in a strange place, in a place that, frankly, is unusual for a Western democracy. A lot of our peer countries do have multi-party democracies, you know, which function in all sorts of different ways. But what they don't do is drive people out of politics in the same way. You know, there's this concept of the big tent party, you know, that we can take all kinds. People with really different views, but with the same general view of, say, you know, our mutual obligations to each other, you know. But what's worrisome is when people don't see it as a big tent, but they're saying, well, it's the only tent in town. Again, that might work in a moment where people are really alarmed by the other candidate, but I do wonder how sustainable it is. Does it mean that every election you have to be in a state of alarm? Maybe justified alarm, but that's not a super healthy place to be. You know, voting is a habit. Democracy is a habit that people get into. One function of third parties in a multi-party situation is that maybe that's how young people get involved in electoral politics. Maybe that's what gets them to realize that they like going door to door and talking to their neighbors. And maybe they end up with one of the bigger, more established parties later in life. But right now we're at a place where that it's not clear where that energy is going. In theory, a third party would be great, and yet it's so worrisome because there's all of these real threats to democracy in the last few years. But another threat to democracy is people feeling deeply alienated from politics and like there is no home for them.
Absolutely. I find it interesting that so many people who are registered as independents still end up voting within the duopoly, as you called it, at some point. Like it's not as though you know, they'd end up not going for either candidate. I mean, it seems like you're either an independent who skews Republican or you're an independent who skews Democrat. And it makes me wonder whether there's, I don't know, I guess any world in which independents could actually sort of be their own thing as opposed to it that term just representing, you know, being unsure or sort of acting as a code for like somewhere between the two parties.
Look, there is a world like that. I mean, it's Bernie Sanders. His idol is Eugene V. Debs, who ran a, obviously not successful, but a strong campaign for president, including one election from a prison cell and getting almost a million votes. And I believe that in that election, he wasn't even the independent candidate that got the most votes. You know, I wouldn't be too sure that, like, it's always been this way and it must always be this way, because things get unsettled more quickly than you might think.
What do you think would have to happen to sort of, have a future that's more similar to, you know, the system that we had in the past? Like, do you think that Sinema becoming an independent is actually opening the doors for something like that? Or do you think that this is just sort of like its own, Sinema is her own thing?
No, I think it's definitely a sign of something that she's she's doing it. I think there are a couple of directions to answer that question in. One is sort of on a more local and state and maybe congressional level, which is this increasing push for nonpartisan primaries, for ranked choice voting, which shakes up the you have to choose A or B, there is no C equation a little bit. Some states are in what I almost would call an experimental phase on that, and we'll see how that goes. Now, at the very top level, the presidential level, even the senatorial level, it's a little trickier because of, again, the Electoral College. I almost wonder if for that to emerge, it might have to start again regionally or to get a boost from a crisis, from a personality. You know, not all of those are good things. There can be terrible third parties and positive third parties and different circumstances in which they emerge.
I feel like we've had some recent, you know, there's Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and Ralph Nader and even Andrew Yang. Like, people have tried recently, but do you think that they just weren't the right people to capture that untapped independent energy? Or
it's a combination of the people and the moment. You know, after the 2016 election, there was a lot of, you know, it's all Gary Johnson and Jill Stein's fault, which, you know, it's mathematically even, you'll never know. You'll never know who stayed home, who only came out to vote for them. It's hard to say. I think because of that moment and how it turned out, there was a broader verdict about third parties that might not be healthy. The idea that third parties are always a mess because you always are taking away from somebody who could actually win.
It's like the Sinema thing. They're almost cast as annoying. It's like, God, yeah, you know, if only they, you know, didn't just like muck up this race by, you know, entering something that they were never going to win and then taking votes from the, you know, the candidate that would have won otherwise.
And at any given moment, that argument makes a lot of sense. But in the, again, in the long term, there has to be a place for voters to go that they don't feel that they're trudging to, you know, out of just reluctance. Because keep in mind, in this country, people can just stay home. It's not even viewed as particularly disreputable to just say I'm not voting at all in a lot of quarters. You know, it's again, democracy has to be something that you live and don't only get alarmed by or come out in an emergency. Otherwise, it tends to take a funny shape. But we've had third parties before that are now our major parties. You know, obviously the Republican Party emerged from like our great crisis over slavery. It may not feel like it, but the American political system does have a historically demonstrated capacity for change. And almost the worst thing you could do is tell people that they just have to, you know, get what you get and don't get upset. Because then they might not. They might just leave politics in some way. Obviously, the other thing that's tricky for third parties in the U.S. is money. It takes a lot of money, which leaves us susceptible to you know, the Perot model, that somebody with a whole lot of money can bypass the two-party system. Is that what we're looking for either? It's hard to say. Andrew Yang, and he's now kind of joined up with Christine Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey, for the Forward Party. I think so far they've been perhaps more successful in reminding people that they would like a third party rather than actually being the third party that those people would like.
We'll have more with Amy Davidson Sorkin in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So, Sinema cited she called it the broken partisan system in Washington as one of her reasons for becoming an independent, which, I mean, on one hand, we all know that the system is broken and partisan, and, you know, it's it seems like both sides are less likely than ever to ever, you know, sort of reconcile or to agree on things. But when you actually look at, you know, sort of what the administration has been able to do, I mean, it seems like they've passed an unusual number of bipartisan bills. We've even talked about some of them during this conversation. And so I guess I'm wondering whether things actually look worse than they seem and whether bipartisan compromise is something that is still achievable without leaving your party, or whether things really do seem broken enough and Sinema's correct, even if technically, you know, there's been, you know, few instances of compromise that we, you know, that we can sort of point to.
Remember, I mean, the Democrats have had control of both houses for the past couple of years. They don't anymore. The Republicans are going to have the House of Representatives. Things get through, but I wonder when I hear that, again, it's this question of entrenchment. On the Republican side, the unimaginability of crossing over, and, you know, on the Democratic side in a different way. One thing that people are talking about with this is Trump, you know, when they talk about brokenness. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the people in the House and the Senate were there on January 6th and fled their chambers. And so the sense of what extremism means, I would only have to imagine, is very present for them. And the idea of colleagues who were also there and maybe put it aside, you know, and how difficult it seems to be to talk about that and to move past it. There seems to be something broken. The other thing that I think that when politicians talk about brokenness and the awfulness of their jobs, a lot of what they're talking about is money. Again, they're talking about how much time they spend raising money, what they need to do to raise it. And it sounds dispiriting. And the sheer amount of money in some of these Senate races this past cycle, you know, a number of them well over $100 million. It's hard to get your head around in that way. I can only imagine that it drives some people out of politics as well.
Do you think that Sinema's ability to fundraise is going to, I mean, do you think that it'll get better now that she's an independent?
It might be less whether she herself can raise the money, but whether the Democratic or Republican senatorial machinery puts money into an opponent for her. There's a Arizona congressman, Ruben Gallego, who has been, you know, talking about had been talking about a primary challenge, and might try to challenge her as the Democratic nominee, how much money, how much backing he gets is going to be pretty decisive, or he or another Democratic candidate. And again, how much energy.
You know, after Sinema made her announcement, there was immediately talk about Joe Manchin maybe doing something similar. I think he was asked about it and he gave like sort of a non-committal, like, oh, he didn't rule it out. But right. He definitely didn't say it was something he was pursuing anytime soon. And it made me think about whether, you know, there ever could be, yeah, I guess like a sort of like a party of like high profile, moderate centrist politicians who come together and form an independent party. And sort of if that's something that could ever happen, or whether it's just impossible because like centrism means a lot of different things. Like obviously Sinema is just her politics are just so different from Murkowski's. And so, yeah. You know, it's one thing to have like a coalition within the Senate, like, you know, the Gang of 14 and whatnot. It's another to actually be like in a political party with these people. And so do you think that, yeah, like an independent party consisting of a bunch of moderates is something that could ever work? And if it did, do you think that it would wield a bunch of power?
It's a great question. You know, because as you say, there's a difference between the idea of a caucus, like a group of gang of what, you know, the problem solvers, the you know, the who come together and vote as a block. And then there's the idea of an actual party that organizes nationally. One thing that some of the people you have in common mention, just to start with that, is that they have very strong profiles in their own states. So one question is, how important is that ingredient? And those states are all over the place, all over the map. The real question, though, that I think you're getting at is, would a third party be more likely to be centrist, or is it more likely to be a splinter in one direction or the other?
It's a question I wish that I asked, yes. whether you're going to have like a centrist party or like a tea party or something, you know?
Right. Whether you have the, you know, Eugene Debs or, you know, Ross Perot, who had some eccentricities but presented himself as a centrist in some ways. And I think that the answer is that it really depends on what's going on with the main parties. If the Republican Party remains, after this nomination cycle, completely captive to its most extreme elements, then you could have a breakaway of the less Trumpist Republicans who find allies on the more conservative end of the Democratic Party. And maybe that could be your third party. On the other hand, if the breakaway from the Republican Party is Trump, if the party itself wrests itself away from him and he still wants to be in the game, then you'd have a very different kind of third party.
It sounds like there's actually a way in which people breaking off from the main parties could actually help the main parties. Like if the Republican Party is sort of divided over this question of Trump and all the Trumpists broke away, then you could just sort of have your classic Republican Party again. And if you're the Democratic yeah. Party and you're dealing with, you know, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin and these other people who you sort of have to lobby in order to get them to vote a certain way, I mean, maybe if they're just kind of their own thing and you don't have to cater to them as much, you know, it just makes for a more cohesive group.
In fairness, there are those in the Democratic Party who would say the sentence you just said, but they would say, so you don't have to deal with AOC and, you know, and Bernie.
That's true, yes.
So there are different ways to picture it, which I guess is part of the message that these things are not preordained. It wouldn't be the strangest thing to ever happen in American democracy to have a third party, and that could take a few different forms. But again, we do seem stuck now. I want to go back, though, to some of the experimentation that's going on. Murkowski, this past race, Alaska did have ranked choice. In the end, there were two Republicans who were left on the ballot. She won because apparently she was the second choice of people who voted for the Democratic candidate. It's going to take, again, some time for us to really reap what's been sown with some of those innovations that are taking place in states. Because again, the, you know, what's called the first past the post, that whoever gets the most gets it all kind of way of doing things, is something that's helped keep two parties entrenched in Congress and in the Senate, and perhaps most of all in the White House. There are a lot of different ways this could take place. It just feels right now that it's not. but there are a lot of real pressures on the system, and we don't necessarily know how they're going to work out. One thing, though, that I'm convinced of is that simply telling people not to think about it because it's too important for them not to think about it is something that can only work in the short term. It's not healthy in the long term. It's bad when people don't feel that electoral politics is something that is worth participating in.
Well, thank you.
Oh, this was fun.
Amy Davidson Sorkin is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can read all of her work at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. If you've been enjoying the new show, one of the best ways you can support it is by leaving a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. Tell us what you've been loving about the show so far. We read every review, and it helps us find new listeners. The show is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Sydney Cobb. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.